Well, tonight I am going to talk about a topic that I have touched on a number of times in the past. We'll see how I do. I'm actually getting over not just bronchitis, pneumonia. So my voice is going to be a little strange. It sounds strange to me. So tonight I want to particularly focus on meta practice. And this is a topic that's important to me, and I know a number of you have really strong meta practices, practices that I am in awe of. So, this is a little bit like Coles to Newcastle. But this does give me an excuse to talk about the Brahma Viharas just as a start. This is, of course, old news to many of you. But the Brahma Viharas are the four states of mind. They're called the abodes of the gods. They are sublime or divine states of mind. There are four of them. And they are said to be the only states of mind that the Buddha had after his enlightenment. I cannot attest to that personally. But the great things about the Brahma Viharas is that these qualities can all be cultivated. There are four of these qualities, four Brahma Viharas. They are metta, which is usually translated as loving kindness. I'm not crazy about that translation. Karuna, compassion. Mudita, usually treated, but not always, as sympathetic joy. And then upekkha, or equanimity. So, a little more about these four before we go into the specifics of what I want to talk about in metta practice. There is a concept called near and far enemies, which I find very useful for understanding the Brahma Viharas. Now, these were not taught by the Buddha. These show up much later from the Visuddhimagga, which was put together in the 5th century AD in Sri Lanka by Buddhaghosa. And interestingly, we know less about Buddhaghosa than we know about the Buddha. The Visuddhimagga was a summation and a distillation of all the commentarial material that was available at the time. And it was so well regarded by his contemporaries that they simply stopped copying a lot of the other materials because they were considered to be redundant. There are some departures from and some additions to what appears in the Pali Canon. It has ended up being quite central to the Theravada teachings. So let's go into this notion of near and far enemies. What I like about near and far enemies is it helps us define or understand what these states of mind are and what they are not. So, metta, loving kindness. And just a side note, I think anytime you end up having a hyphenated word as your translation, it indicates that there are not very many good translations for a particular word. I like to think of metta as radiant friendliness, and I've heard teachers use that phrase. And I like it in part because it feels that way to me. Loving kindness kind of has this greeting card resonance to it. So, metta, loving kindness, or well wishing. The far enemy, this is obvious. The far enemies are sort of like opposites. The far enemy of metta is anger or ill will. The near enemy, which gets much more interesting, is selfish affection, the translation from the Visuddhimagga. So things like lust or codependence. The point I'm see here is that true metta is not self-interested. All these other aspects, the near enemies, have this selfishness about them. There is something truly generous, outgoing, and other-oriented about complete and full metta. So karuna, compassion. The far enemy, of course, is cruelty. Near enemy is pity, because pity implies aversion or even condescension, sort of like relief that it's not you. I'm so glad that's not happening to me. And mudita, sympathetic joy. This is happiness for others, for the good fortune of others. When you see somebody having a good time, you're just happy for them. The usual example is the joy of a parent watching their child's growth and accomplishments. The far enemy is resentment or envy. It's fairly obvious. It's, you don't want that other person to be happy because you feel like you deserve it for yourself. That they don't deserve it, you do. The near enemy is usually translated as frivolous delight or exuberance. I don't quite understand that, and I have a feeling that that's been lost in the way idiom shifts over time. But to me, that implies a vicarious enjoyment, like, oh, I'd feel really good if that happened to me, or that's my friend having all those wonderful, that's my friend who just won the Pulitzer Prize. I know this important person. I'm enjoying the basking in the reflected glory of this other person's happiness. The fourth of the Brahma Viharas is upekkha, equanimity. Now, this is a tricky one for, I think, anyone to understand. And Philip Moffat has given a whole talk on the topic of equanimity, and several other teachers have here as well. I could spend an hour on equanimity. It's not the same as serenity or calm. It upekkha is about clarity and balance, even in the midst of chaos. The far enemy is craving or clinging. So that's sort of the opposite. Upekkha is not about craving or clinging. There is a freedom in upekkha. The near enemy, and this is important, is indifference or apathy. Upekkha is not about apathy. It's not about not caring. You can care very deeply. Upekkha is something that helps keep us in balance with all of the other Brahma Viharas. It keeps us from being inundated, for instance, by other people's suffering. This is important for caregivers. Caregivers talk a lot about compassion burnout. Equanimity is what keeps you from suffering from compassion burnout. So one way of looking at the four Brahma Viharas is that metta, loving kindness, is a fundamental attitude. A basic viewpoint, a paradigm that we might have for just perceiving what's going on around us. Karuna, compassion, is metta as it encounters someone in suffering. It's the quiver of the heart when it sees suffering, including suffering in yourself. Self-compassion is a really important practice. Mudita, or sympathetic joy, is metta, loving kindness, when it encounters someone who is happy, who is enjoying something. And equanimity is what keeps us balanced in the midst of all this. So what I think is common across all the near enemies is selfing. Notice the, I'm backing up here in my notes. The near enemy of metta is selfish affection, like lust or codependence. Metta, true metta, pure metta, is not self-interested. It's completely free of that. Mudita, sympathetic joy, is happiness for others without the complication of what's in it for me. What can I enjoy? There's no vicarious enjoyment there. It's simply happiness or that someone else is having something good And upekkha is what keeps us balanced. And there is apathy or indifference are a way of separating ourself from what's going on. So there's this, that's the aspect of selfing. Upekkha is not selfish. So I think what's common across all the near enemies, in my opinion, is that there's selfing going on. So it's worthwhile to be mindful that unless you are enlightened, your Brahma Viharas are always mixed. The near enemy is always present to some degree. There's always an element of self. That's okay. We're not enlightened. We're doing the best we can. But I think you can learn a lot from observing this. When you're experiencing metta or mudita or karuna, just notice what was the flavor of self in there. Just how involved are you? Just how pure is that generosity? So Brahma Viharas are often talked about as exalted states. They are beautiful, which means also that they are very pleasurable. We like exalted states. The mind and the body like exalted states. So there's a challenge for us because we are normally not mindful of beautiful or exalted states. Our minds like to go looking for trouble. Our minds like to solve problems. And that's been good for getting us to where we are. Two people wandering around the savannah 100,000 years ago, one who is really grooving on things is less likely to survive and pass on his or her genes than someone who's worried about whether or not they smell a nearby lion. So solving problems is what got us here. The person who is drifting around grooving or smelling the flowers, the lions of the day can thank this person for helping to nourish their ancestors. We can thank the trouble seeker, the problem solver for helping us to survive being eaten by lions and pass on their genes to us today. So we have the problem of having minds that look for trouble all the time. But we can learn to live with that, and we can learn to better cope with that kind of thinking. So again, we're normally not mindful of beautiful or exalted states. And the Buddha was aware of this. The Satipatthana Sutta, it's usually said four foundations of mindfulness. I'm hearing much more often these days four establishments of mindfulness, which is a much, much better translation. One of the parts of the fourth establishment of mindfulness is being mindful of the presence of the hindrances, the five hindrances, and being mindful of their absence. And I want you to know that when the hindrances are weakened, when they're not very strong, when they're at bay, this is an enormously pleasant state of mind to be in. This is an exalted state of mind. But we don't usually notice when the hindrances are absent. We go looking for trouble somewhere else. We do notice when they are present and we try to get rid of them. Okay. So when the Brahma Viharas are strong, the hindrances are weakened. So this is another aspect of Brahma Vihara practice that's worthwhile. I also want to emphasize that the Brahma Viharas are experienced in the mind and in the body. One of the words that shows up a lot in Pali, in the suttas, is citta. Citta is usually translated, it's often translated as the mind or the body, but the literal translation is heart mind, another hyphenated word. But in the Buddha's time, the heart and the mind were not considered as separate as separate things. So we tend, especially I think in the West, to think of the mind and the body as being very separate. It's a very dualistic approach. We're so used to it that we tend not to notice emotion in the body, unless the emotion is very, very strong. anger will tend to notice that will tighten up in places, for instance, or will experience heat. But how often do we really notice or remember what love feels like in the body, what happiness or contentment or satisfaction? So this is an aside, of course, that I think cultivating mindfulness of pleasant states is an important practice for cultivating happiness. And the Brahmaviharas can be a part of cultivation of happiness. So I finally get around to talking about practices. So we talk a lot in our lineage about samatha and vipassana practices. Samatha is usually described as concentration practice and vipassana as insight practice. So samatha is calming, unifying, can lead to potentially ecstatic states. It's a great way to settle the mind. By the way, I hate the word concentration in this context because for me, and I think from other people that I've talked to, it's more about relaxation than about effort. Concentration sounds like you're squeezing something to make it smaller. Sort of like concentrated orange juice in these little cans, and it's sort of like you squeeze out this sort of gunky thing and then you add a bunch of water to make it drinkable. So concentration for me has a lot of connotations that are just not helpful. So it's more about relaxed effort, relaxed awareness. And I try to explicitly with myself and in guided sits appeal to relaxed awareness rather than talk about being concentrated. So vipassana, often called insight practice, is about fully receiving the experience of the senses without as much noise from the analyzing mind, without so much of a narrative. These two approaches to practice are the supports for mindfulness, the ability to be in the present moment, for showing up for our lives. So, concentration practice, notice my air quotes around concentration. Concentration practice provides the strength, the ability to stay with. Mindfulness practice gives us the discernment. There's this old metaphor taught by Buddhadasa, the Thai teacher, of the someone who's trying to get through a big thicket of jungle to get to the lake beyond. And the lake is cooling and soothing. It's a metaphor for enlightenment, or at least for greater enlightenment. And the thicket is all the stuff between us and enlightenment. So if you have a baseball bat and you try to beat against that bamboo, the bat's just going to bounce off. The bat is the metaphor for concentration practice. If you have a razor blade, you might spend a couple hours and cut through one of those stalks of tough bamboo. But that's not going to get you very far. What you need is one of those really sharp Southeast Asian machetes. It's got to be sharp and it's got to have weight. The sharpness is the discernment of mindfulness, the weight is the strength of concentration. So Brahmavihara practices help balance these, concentration and mindfulness, and helps bring them into the heart. People often find meditation practices to be dry. They don't have to be that way. And I think with development, they're not. They're very rich. They're very rewarding. But when you start out, when you're just following the breath is boring. Let's face it, it's boring. Actually, it isn't. When you really get into following the breath, it can get very interesting. But at first, it's boring. And it just seems like you're going nowhere. And when you're mindfulness, you can easily feel like a human barcode reader. So, metta helps balance that by working to open the heart and give us a friendly attitude towards our experience. That's why I always start my sits just with a little bit of, gratitude, because gratitude helps me kickstart a metta practice if I'm doing metta sit, or it helps me have a friendly attitude towards my experience in that sit. So there are exercises for cultivating all of the Brahma-Viharas, but the most common one, the most commonly taught one, is for loving kindness and metta. And because metta is really the starting point for the other three, it's hard to have strong compassion if you don't have the loving kindness that acts as the underpinning for it. And the same goes with mudita. Loving kindness is surprisingly a samatha practice or a concentration practice. It's usually taught as a mixture of visualization and chant. And it can actually lead to jhana, the deep states of absorption. And for many years, and I think still at places like IMS, for people who want to move towards jhana practice, it is taught as the path to jhana. When I first heard that, I thought that was laughable. I thought that was just ridiculous. Because for me, the way that metta has been traditionally taught got me so much in my cogitating head that I could not imagine that anybody could really develop any kind of concentration doing it. Now, I'll talk more about that in a little while. But back to the loving kindness as a balance with the mindfulness practices. This gives me an excuse to read one of my favorite quotes. It's from Gil Fronsdale. The practices of mindfulness and loving kindness support one another. Metta practice complements mindfulness by encouraging an attitude of friendliness toward our experience, regardless of how difficult it may be. Mindfulness complements loving kindness by guarding it from becoming partial or sentimental. Mindfulness can bring freedom. Loving kindness ensures that our path to freedom is not aloof from others. This is so important. I'm going to go through it again. Practices of mindfulness and loving kindness support one another. They're complementary. Metta practice complements mindfulness by encouraging an attitude of friendliness towards our experience. Regardless of how difficult it might be, it's great to have that predisposition of friendliness because that really helps us get through tougher times. It won't make the times less tough. It won't make our mood better, perhaps, but maybe it'll just lean us a little bit more towards that friendliness. Mindfulness complements loving kindness by guarding it from becoming partial or sentimental. Metta can get gooey. It can really get kind of like grippy. It can get like a Hallmark greeting card. And that's not helpful. There's a lot of selfing in that. There's a lot of self-indulgence in that kind of cloying sweetness. Mindfulness helps us avoid that. It guards us from it. From the partiality, that's a word that he uses, and I think it's important. It helps us from getting selfish about it. Mindfulness can bring freedom. Loving kindness ensures that our path to freedom is not aloof from others, that we stay in the world of compassion and well-wishing and enjoyment. We stay in the world of generosity. So the practice, as it's classically taught, is to direct well-wishing towards someone. This starts traditionally taught, but I want to emphasize at the beginning that the Buddha did not teach it this way. This is all pretty much from the Suttamagga. And the traditional way is just calm, settle the mind, start perhaps with some focusing on the breathing. Then you choose a recipient, someone to whom you direct the well-wishing. Could be a benefactor, someone for whom you have gratitude. Someone for when you think of this person, you can't help but smile. I love that phrase. And you visualize that recipient and you hold that person in your heart. And then you direct well-wishing, loving kindness towards that person. There are traditional chants and variants on that. There's Philip's chant, which was developed by a group of prisoners at San Quentin. The theme of it usually breaks down into four chants, although I know people who've developed three or five phrases. But usually it's safety, happiness, good health, and ease or well-being or knowing freedom. You visualize the recipient enjoying these qualities. And as the metta deepens, these words may fall away. And then traditionally, you progress through an order of recipients. It starts easy, it gets harder. Originally, in the Visuddhimagga, it's taught that you start with yourself and then move to the benefactor. Westerners often find this a little tough. We have, I think, more self-loathing in our culture. But the Buddha himself said, you can search the world over and find that no one deserves happiness more than you. I find it helpful when I'm doing myself to visualize myself in as a child, as a small child, before I developed all my bad karma. But many people like to start with the benefactor. So the traditional order is to start with the self and move to the benefactor, then to a loved one, then to a friend, then to a neutral person, then to a difficult person, and then to all beings radiating loving kindness out over the entire world. This progression could take place over one sit, over a long retreat. It's okay, I think, in my opinion, to stay with the easy ones. It's a very rewarding practice. And sometimes we feel like we're just in a schmaltzy, silly Hallmark greeting card. And it seems just kind of silly. And sometimes negative stuff comes up. When we try to do metta practice, what's going to come up is the stuff that causes trouble in metta practice, stuff that impedes our metta practice. So I think it's important to experiment with balance because everyone is different. You want to do what works for you. Philip, for instance, likes his chant. I find it too wordy. I know other people who do as well. Some don't chant at all, but visualize. The Venerable Anālayo sticks to the practice in the Pali Canon. Now, it's in part because he is very much a purist about the Pali Canon. Here's the practice as it appears in the words of the Buddha from the Pali Canon. He then pervades the first direction with a heart filled with loving kindness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, and all around. He pervades the entire world everywhere and equally with a heart filled with loving kindness, abundant, expansive, limitless, free from enmity and ill will. Just as a mighty trumpeter makes himself heard without difficulty in all four directions, even so, of all things that have shape or life, there is not one that he passes by or leaves aside, but regards them all with a heart set free through deep felt loving kindness. This is from the Tavija Sutta. It's an excerpt, by the way, from the Digha Nikaya 13.76. So that is what he's saying is to develop metta in the heart and radiate it in all directions. Excuse me. And that's it. He doesn't do any other practices that we know of in the Pali Canon. Now, one thing I think is very helpful for me is that when the metta is working, there's some direct physical sense of joy. Joy in the body. It's not just me. I've heard this from other people, and I know that there are yet other people who do not experience this. But I think that this is something that can be cultivated. I certainly hope so. For me, I find it very helpful to kickstart it with gratitude and to feel that in the body, because that just starts with a pleasant feeling that is itself radiant. Metta is felt in the body, and it's felt, there are two components, piti, which is usually translated as joy or rapture, and sukha, usually translated as happiness. These two, by the way, are two of the five jhana factors. I'm not going to go into jhana practice, but these are important qualities to develop for deep absorption states. This is one of the reasons why I like the phrase radiant friendliness instead of loving kindness, because for me, it's a better description of how it actually feels. So one thing that I like to do is I breathe in gratitude and breathe out generosity, so that the breath and the metta are going together. In breath, I find energizing. So ask yourself, if you want to try this, can you feel the in-breath at the top of the head? Is there a sense of rising? The in-breath is where piti tends to be more obvious, stronger. By the way, the in-breath, if you're having trouble with the hindrance of sloth and torpor, if you're feeling sleepy, try focusing more on the in-breath than on the out-breath. Likewise, if you're feeling jittery or agitated, try focusing the attention more on the out-breath, because the out-breath tends to be more soothing, more expansive. There may be a sense of radiance, of release. Out-breath is more associated with sukha, with happiness, with this soothing, honey-like quality. With the breath like this, breathing in gratitude and energizing, and with piti, and the out-breath, the sense of radiance release, breathing in gratitude, breathing out generosity, a feedback loop can develop, an amplitude can grow. And this is also a development of generosity of spirit. That is, metta and generosity are really bound together, I think. When you're sending out metta and well-wishing, you are doing it with generosity. You're sending it out. A stingy person has trouble doing metta. Metta is a great way of developing generosity. Generosity is a great way of developing metta. And the two of them together help build happiness. A metta retreat is a great way to experiment, because you're in an environment, in a context where the practice is encouraged. And that really does help. You can play around with the chanting versus the visualization versus does it work to try to tie metta to the breath? An aside, by the way, I think curiosity is really important, and curiosity is something that you can really take the time to indulge in when you're on a metta retreat. You can use curiosity at home too, of course. And the aside that I want to make here is that there are seven awakening factors, which I have talked about before. I'm not going to talk about them tonight, but the second of the seven awakening factors is usually translated as investigation. And I believe that investigation would be meaningless without some underlying fundamental curiosity. So I think curiosity is a really important spiritual faculty to develop. And this is a place where curiosity can be really helpful to develop or to deepen one's metta practice. So I went through a lot of things, tying metta to generosity, seeing about tying metta to the breath. And this may sound like a lot of suggestions, and The downside of this is that it's very easy to get caught up in analysis here. Besides, many of you already have meta practices that I am in awe of, and I can only hope in this context to help you deepen your experience or not. But I would not suggest setting up a checklist of these suggestions because that would just lead to judgment like, oh, this is crazy. This doesn't work. Or my meta practice is never going to work for me. This suggestion is really stupid. I won't do that. Or you'll lapse into analysis of trying to do it all at once. So if you're curious about these things, what I would suggest is try just one aspect, like starting a sit with gratitude. Simple enough, just try to see if you can evoke a little bit of gratitude at the beginning of the sit, and then just go continue on and do the sit how as you would normally. I'm talking about a meta sit, but this would also apply to a regular sit following the breath, or to any sort of sit. Gratitude is a great way to start a choiceless awareness sit, for instance. Another aspect that might be worth trying if you haven't in the past is see what metta feels like in the body. Just try to be aware of how the body feels or doesn't feel. One thing about loving kindness is if you're just starting the practice or if it's new to you and you don't feel loving kindness, that's okay. We're cultivating loving kindness. If it was just really easy for us to have loving kindness, we'd be basking in it all the time. So it's about setting our intentions and developing loving kindness. We've seen plenty of people who develop anger pathways, reinforce their neural patterns for anger. Let's not do that. Let's see if we can develop our capability, our capacity for kindness, for loving kindness, for happiness. There are also traditional practices to cultivate karuna, compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, and upekkha, but metta is the basis for all of these, in my opinion, and should first be strong. And it's a rewarding practice all by itself. So metta practice really helps us develop happiness, cultivate happiness in ourselves and in the people around us. Gratitude is a powerful practice that supports metta. Metta cultivates generosity of spirit, and there's a strong relationship, I think, between generosity and happiness. Metta is a physically pleasurable experience and an experience that's wholesome. The Buddha once said, somebody said, how can you keep all those monks from running off to the nearest bordello or bar or some other place for the physical pleasures of the world? And the Buddha said, oh, they have wholesome pleasures like a metta and jhana practice. And as in the Gil Fronsdale quote, metta is a fundamental support for wisdom and liberation. And this gives me an excuse to repeat one of my favorite quotes about the balance of wisdom and compassion. This is from Nisargadatta Maharaj, who says, wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. Between the two, my life flows. Gee, I'd like my life to flow that way too. Doesn't always do that, but at least I have an aspiration. So we have time for comments, questions. Particularly, I know a number of people here have tremendous metta practices and may have suggestions or elaborations of their own. So, all right. So, Zoe, go ahead and unmute yourself.
So I just want to say thank you, Bill. This was a wonderful talk. I really love all the talks that we have that involve metta. And There's a lot of points, just so many things. One of the things that I just want to comment that I've never forgotten Philip Moffitt's meta practice that we used to do when we met as a group. It is so strong for me that is one of the few things that I can just repeat in my mind like a prayer. And I often do when I need to settle myself down and at the end of the day or in the morning or just whenever I need to think about wishing, everyone well. And it's been such a powerful, like a blessing in my life. But it was interesting tonight because, in short, I had for the last 3 days, I had two of my accounts hacked, my credit cards, which threw me into a tailspin. And I've spent the last 3 days trying to rectify, including having to go to the police station today, which was not a fun experience. So when I sat down, I was just finally settling. And I started off in the meta practice, and then my phone rang twice for which was unusual with unknown phone calls from unknown people, which threw me right into a tailspin again. And I realized that for me, that meta really needs to start with equanimity. I need to be sort of balanced within myself, not be upset or in turmoil about something in order to have the practice continue because it really threw me off once the phone rang and I didn't know who it was. And that threw me into a state of panic and fear and a suspicious mind, like who's calling me? And is this someone else trying to scam my, some information? I really had a hard time coming back. And so I don't know if you have any comments, but I find it easy to do the meta practice when I'm relaxed and things are going well, but it's more challenging, of course, when there's something that's going on that's not going well and you're trying to, gather yourself and center yourself enough to radiate, some goodwill.
I think you bring up a good point, and I said earlier, and I think for many people this is still helpful. You start with metta, and but equanimity can't help with metta practice, and sometimes it's just a matter of, I mean, equanimity implies a lot that is sort of beyond anything I can go into tonight. I think a little bit of equanimity helps everything, but it's hard to get a lot of equanimity without the loving kindness as well. So, and I think you've seen that it's hard to have metta when you're really jittery. I love Philip's phrases. There's a formality about them that I find very powerful. I find them a little bit too wordy for meta practice, but I love ending the evening on them. We have a meditation group that meets in another context, and we've ended that sits we've ended those sessions, and one of our long-term members used Philip's four phrases as a blessing for his daughter's wedding. Which I told Philip that too. I think he was very pleased to hear that.
Nice.
So, Patty.
Thank you, Bill. That was wonderful. I agree. I use those phrases all the time, and I wish people a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart. And I wish people, when they're getting married again, I wish them ex may they experience love, joy, wonder, and wisdom. Anyway, those phrases are great. I agree. But the comment I want to make is something else I learned from Philip that I find incredibly helpful. I was once in a very difficult situation where I was ambivalent and could not make a decision. And I was stuck there for years in ambivalence. And Philip taught me to send metta to the situation, not just to myself, but to the situation, because I was totally stuck. And it really helped a lot. And I said, well, how do I wish well? Which side am I wishing well? I couldn't make a decision between A and B. He said, you don't have to. You just send metta to the situation, may it be resolved for the, in the best possible way. And that has helped me countless times since then. So I just wanted to share that
Well,
sending metta to the situation helps me a lot.
thank you. That's wonderful. I'm assuming that it helped you make that decision.
It
And
did. It did. It wasn't easy, but it helped a lot. It got me unstuck.
good. Well, thank you for that. I'll have to try that next time I'm lost in ambivalence. Thank you. Deborah.
Okay, first of all, Bill, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I know you acquired all your wisdom sitting underneath the tree I see behind you. Wow, you just said so many things that set off so many little bursts of, oh, yeah, in my brain tonight. So thank you for that. Maybe you've heard Sharon Salzberg also talk about loving kindness not being a word that she cares for and that she prefers radiating kindness or something like that. I was hearing her say that actually not too long ago, but I can't remember exactly. And I also want to give a shout out to Phillips, to the metta that we did, because every morning, actually, before I get out of bed, I put my hand on my heart and I say, may I have a calm, clear mind and a peaceful, loving heart. And it's really nice. It's really good because there's the physical and the verbal and the, as you said, the aspiration. I really love that word. And I'll say one more thing to remind myself of something I remember about Philip saying one night at Sangha years ago. He was talking about forgiveness. And I probably don't have this exact, but he said, if you can't forgive this person or whatever, forgive yourself for not being able to forgive just then. And there are two people I can think of on this planet who I just cannot bring myself to send metta to. One of them is a well-known public figure, and one of them is a person I know in a personal way. And so I am, from your talk tonight, I say thank you again, sending metta to you for reminding me of that statement that came out of Philip's mouth so many years ago, to forgive myself for not being able to metta these two particular people.
Right. And there are some people who are just really hard to do metaphor. And classically, you're supposed to get around to them eventually. But I usually wuss out and just stay with the easy ones just because it is so pleasant to do so.
Well, I'm just grateful that I don't wish them ill. You know, it's like I'm not sending you metta, but I don't wish you any harm.
Okay.
You know, I don't wish you ill. I don't wish you any harm, but I'm not sending you any love right now. So thank you, Bill.
So, Barbara.
Yeah, I wanted to add to the tailspin metta because I really appreciate what Patty said, particularly, but also what Deborah said about metta for oneself. Because I, when I'm in a tailspin, I sometimes notice not only metta for myself, hand on heart, but metta for my body. And really, my poor body is like all these cells are just kind of going nuts. And if I can really kind of get in touch with that, oh, may you be safe. May you have compassion. I care about your suffering. That sometimes can really help. And it can also lead to a greater compassion where you realize, oh, a lot of people are out there suffering. But to be able to sort of see all those multiple parts of the body really going through it helps.
Okay, I think we have time for one more. So, Cherie or Bowman, whoever.
Bill, thanks. Great talk. I heard a lot of really great things tonight. I really like your phrase for metta of radiant friendliness. That just makes more sense than loving kindness. You also had a definition for concentration, and I forget what it was.
I used relaxed awareness or relaxed
Relaxed
attention.
awareness, yes.
And I think that's helpful. I don't know if that would be if I call that a definition,
Well, yes, right.
but it is helpful. I find it much easier to go even into fairly deep states of calm mind, of unified mind, by just staying very relaxed. If I try to concentrate, I create struggle, and that's
Yes,
not
right.
helpful at all.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, great talk. Thank you,
Oh,
Bill.
thank you.
Thank you so much.